the seismic Supreme Court ruling on presidential immunity that could shape America for years to come.
There is a principle that nobody is above the law, and it has always been understood that the president himself has to abide by the law. This opinion, not only does it grant this immunity, but it grants the immunity in some really sweeping ways, I think go far beyond anything anybody could have assumed.
Plus, thousands of Palestinians displaced multiple times already are ordered to relocate once again.
The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
And the European leader with the closest ties to Russia meets with Ukraine's president in a rare visit to Kyiv. Today is July 2nd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Lori London. Israeli forces bombarded several areas of southern Gaza Tuesday, and thousands of Palestinians fled their homes in what could be part of a final push of Israel's intensive military operations in 9 months of war. Associated Press correspondent Yosef Fetterman reports.
The Israeli military has ordered a mass evacuation from a large part of the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. This isn't the first time we've seen an evacuation order like this. Israel spent several months inside Khan Yunis battling Hamas before withdrawing earlier this year. The latest order is a sign that Hamas has managed to regroup, and we could soon see Israeli forces moving back into Khan Yunis and a resumption of heavy fighting.
AP correspondent Yosef Fetterman. Gaza's European hospital in Khan Yunis is virtually empty, with staff and patients fleeing after the Israeli army's orders for residents in the surrounding areas to evacuate. UNRWA spokesperson Louise Waterridge.
UNRWA estimates that around 250,000 people have been impacted by these orders. Of course, as usual, we expect these numbers to grow. But, you know, for us, this is it's another devastating blow to the humanitarian response here. It's another devastating blow for the people and the families on the ground. It seems that they are forcibly being displaced again and again. You know, making these decisions is now impossible.
Meanwhile, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken affirmed Monday that President Joe Biden's proposal to end the Israel-Hamas conflict is achievable and urged Hamas to accept it. Blinken also underlined the importance of post-war plans to rebuild Gaza and prevent a security vacuum in the territory. VOA's Veronica Balteras-Inglesias reports.
As Israeli troops continue deepening their incursions in Gaza in search of militants, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced Monday that Hamas's military capabilities have almost been eliminated.
We are advancing to the end of the phase of eliminating the terrorist army of Hamas, and there will be a continuation to strike its remnants.
The announcement was made as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, in an interview at the Brookings Institution in Washington, called on Hamas's leadership to accept a phased peace proposal currently on the table.
I think the proposal that President Biden put forward is achievable. And it would be the best way forward, the quickest way to end the conflict in Gaza, to stop the violence, to massively surge assistance, to get everyone home, including American hostages.
As the secretary spoke, the voices of protesters gathered outside the Brookings Institution could also be heard. Blinken, who didn't acknowledge them, stressed that the Israel-Hamas conflict cannot end with a vacuum in Gaza.
It has to end in a way that makes sure that there are clear, coherent, achievable plans for Gaza's governance, for its security, and of course, to start to help people to rebuild their lives that have been so decimated and destroyed.
One of the Palestinians whose life has radically changed and wants accountability is Dr. Mohammed Abu Selmeya. The director of Al-Shifa Hospital was released early Monday after being in Israeli custody since November. He says prisoners were subjected to severe torture and his little finger was broken. He was repeatedly hit on the head until he bled. He says there was almost daily torture in Israeli prisons.
We were subjected to severe torture.
This is VOA. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
This is a recipe for going literally nowhere and could see global climate efforts go backwards at a time when we simply must move forward.
That was UN Climate Chief Simon Stile on the difficulty of getting progress towards a climate financial deal. Details coming up. Also, official results show the opposition leader in Somalia's breakaway region of Somaliland won last week's election. And the standoff continues by illegal miners refusing to leave an abandoned shaft because they face arrest in South Africa. All these and more on in Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story, the refusal of hundreds of illegal miners to resurface from an abandoned gold mine in South Africa's northwest province is proving a challenge for the government. A court hearing set for today to decide if the miners should be given food and water was postponed while government efforts to mount a rescue have made no progress. Tuso Kumalo reports from Pretoria.
The rescue of the illegal miners at the Stilfontein gold mine has been met by delays and legal challenges, leaving their families, community leaders, and human rights lawyers worried. The miners and their backers were left disappointed Tuesday with the postponement of a court session meant to decide if the miners should be given food. Yasmin Omar is the attorney who helped to bring the case of the miners to court.
The fact is the police continue the blockade and they're controlling the entry and exit point of the mine. The people are stuck underground. And what has happened is now they are so weak from no food being given to them. And notwithstanding what the state organs are saying, there's simply no food being given to them.
But police spokesperson Atlenda Mate told reporters outside court that the police have not stopped anyone from resurfacing and are only guarding the exit to prevent criminal activities by the illegal miners.
This is the best kind of strategy that we as law enforcement can come up with to say resurface in a safe and secure manner and you will be processed accordingly.
The miners have been stuck underground for weeks after police surrounded the mine to arrest those who came out. At least one has died and those helping the miners say others are very sick. A government-organized rescue team Tuesday visited the mine to make its initial assessment of what will be required to get the miners up from more than 2 kilometers underground. It is not clear when the rescue mission will begin. Community leader Johannes Kankase told VOA that they want rescue efforts to be sped up to avoid any more deaths of the stranded miners.
We know that when it comes to procurement issues of the government, they delay sometimes. Most of the time they delay, but we hope and trust they will take this matter as an urgent matter, as much as we know that there are people who are still trapped underground who need assistance urgently.
Nomahlubi Kwinana, who sits on the South African Human Rights Commission, has cautioned all parties involved to observe the rights of the illegal miners as prescribed by the Constitution.
Our worry really is to ensure that the rights that are enshrined in the Constitution are observed, the right to food, the right to water, and of course, no violation of human rights. It doesn't matter what the circumstances are, but there should not be violation of human rights in the process.
South Africa's high rate of unemployment has driven many people into illegal mining in 7 of the country's 9 provinces. These are largely communities that were left undeveloped by companies that have abandoned old mines because they are no longer profitable to operate. South Africa has long banned illegal mining, arguing the practice is not safe and that the government loses tax revenue from it. In addition, there are concerns that many of the miners are victims of human trafficking. For VOA News, I am Tuso Kumalo in Pretoria.
The opposition leader in Somalia's breakaway region of Somaliland won last week's election, according to results announced today by the Electoral Commission. Abdurrahman Mohamed Abdullahi of the Wadini Party received more than 50% of the votes. President Musi Bihi Abdi of the ruling Kulmiya Party, who was seeking a second term, came second with just over 30%. Somaliland declared independence from Somalia in 1991 and has sustained its own government, currency and security structures despite lacking international recognition. Russia vetoed a UN Security Council resolution on Monday calling for an immediate end to the war in Sudan between two rival generals that has been raging since April 2023. A draft of the resolution prepared by Britain and Sierra Leone urged both sides to begin talks on a national ceasefire. David Monda, professor of political science at City University of New York, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shanawi the reasons behind Russia's veto.
I think Russia is very much concerned with two things, with being excluded by virtue of this veto to its continual influence and support to the RSF, led by General Mohamed Dagalo Hemedit. Russia is concerned about losing its influence to other powers in the region, including the United States, including France, Turkey, that are also involved in the conflict. There'll be no way of supervising who can or cannot be involved in the region. But I think also, thirdly, Russia is also very dependent on the RSF and the gold coming from the Sudanese gold mines in generating currency, in generating resources for its war in Ukraine. But also gold is an important means through which Russia can circumvent sanctions. So I think from those multiple levels of security and trade interests, Russia does not want to be excluded from intervening in the region. Also remembering that Russia is eyeing Sudan for a base on the Red Sea coast in Port Sudan.
The draft had called on member states to avoid any external interference which foments conflict and instability, and urged all sides to respect an embargo against arms transfer. Sudan's army under Burhan has accused the United Arab Emirates of providing arms to the paramilitary rapid support forces, RSF, a charge rejected by Abu Dhabi. Will regional players at least stop interfering in the Sudan conflict?
I definitely don't think so. Regional players have a direct interest in interfering in the Sudan conflict. Russia has tended to play its political game in Sudan very cleverly. At one time, it was hedging its bets in Sudan, providing support for the government on one hand, the Sudanese armed forces, but also using the Wagner Group when Yevgeny Prigozhin, the head of the Wagner Group, was still alive, to also give support through the United Arab Emirates to the rebels. So Russia was playing both sides. Russia benefits a lot from the gold trade. Sudan is one of the largest producers of gold on the continent. If Mohamed Dagalo Hemedi is able to become president, Russia will have an immediate ally. But also in terms of strategic goals, Russia is also very keen to have an influence and eventually probably a naval base, you know, in Port Sudan on the Red Sea. So Russia does not want to lose that access and that influence through its proxies to support the RSF, but also its influence in terms of supplying arms to the Sudanese army. And I think this resolution would be a direct threat to that. So in Russia vetoing that, it has essentially truncated any kind of UN effort to try and stop regional actors from getting involved in this conflict.
Some experts say that the United Nations has been largely paralyzed in its ability to deal with conflicts from Ukraine, Sudan to Gaza because of splits between permanent Security Council members, notably Russia and the United States. Who else can help put an end to the war in Sudan?
I think probably the middle powers, because the United States and Russia are two major powers that do not want to cede any ground in this area. The Arab League, the Organization of Islamic States, but more importantly, the African Union. I think the AU needs to be incentivized to get involved. So the UN will, you know, its efforts will be moot because the UN is only as good as its constituent parts. And if UN members are not willing to cooperate, if other regional organizations cannot do anything to bring these two belligerents, the two generals, to the negotiating table, I think we're going to see another long, long drawn-out war. Particularly, this conflict is going to go on for a long time, not only because of the regional actors, but the fear from Khartoum with the Sudan Armed Forces that if Hemedti in any way is able to win, then there's a prospect that Darfur, the western part of Sudan, will want to secede and make its own country. And I think that is something that, you know, the Sudan Armed Forces, you know, will never live to want to see, because South Sudan has already broken off.
That was David Manda, professor of political science at City University of New York, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shinawi. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Find us on voaafrica.com. You'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. And we'd love to hear from you. You can share your thoughts about the news and our programs by WhatsApp. The number is +1 202 258 3076. Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing our listeners' comments on African News Tonight. The United Nations has delivered its strongest message yet at the COP29 summit for countries to deliver a new financial deal to tackle the global climate crisis. Negotiations are focusing on how to get more than $1 trillion to developing nations before 2030 so they can cut gas emissions that are causing global warming and cope with the impacts of extreme weather. Darren Taylor reports.
Participants at the climate summit in Baku, Azerbaijan, have told VOA one of the blocks to progress is the question of whether China should help pay for the cost of climate change in the global south. China says it shouldn't, because its industrialization arrived too late to cause the most damage to the atmosphere. Beijing's position is that developed countries, primarily in North America and Europe, should provide the bulk of climate financing because they've been burning coal for centuries. These countries hit back, saying China's been the world's worst polluter for many years and is responsible for over 30% of global carbon emissions. At a briefing on Monday, UN Climate Chief Simon Steele didn't call out individual countries, instead delivering a general message to political leaders to roll up their sleeves and deliver a climate financing deal within days.
If we want to succeed here, we cannot afford to keep getting stuck in negotiating silos. To put it another way, we can't lose sight of the forest because we're tussling over individual trees. We also cannot afford any outbreak of you first-ism, where groups of parties dig in and refuse to move on one issue until others move elsewhere. This is a recipe for going literally nowhere and could see global climate efforts go backwards at a time when we simply must move forward.
Dean Bebe of Power Shift Africa, a non-profit pushing for fair climate financing, says richer countries remain unwilling to take moral responsibility for rising temperatures. He tells VOA the recent U.S. election, which confirmed Donald Trump's return to the White House in 2025, is providing an excuse for inaction in some developed countries. Trump has called climate change a hoax and threatened to take the U.S. out of agreements to lower carbon emissions. He also pledged during the election campaign to roll back some U.S. green energy programs.
That has created a sort of a tension point in terms of we've seen a lot of countries hiding behind the United States, because then, obviously, they're one of the world's biggest economies happens to be led by a climate skeptic. So this has really then caused a ripple effect where we see the new collective quantified goal, which is what would determine the amount of quantity and quality of climate finance that Africa is going to ideally receive. And we see a lot of nations very nervous and backtracking a lot on that, because obviously the United States is holding the playing cards.
Bebe says it's going to be difficult for Africa and other vulnerable regions to survive the heat if the world's richest country and second worst polluter isn't one of the biggest contributors to climate financing. Steele reminded wealthy countries it's in their interest to help the poorest, which are suffering the most floods and drought, but have done little to cause global warming.
We'll only get the job done if parties are prepared to step forward in parallel, getting us closer to common ground. The bluffing, brinksmanship, and premeditated playbooks are burning up precious time and running down the goodwill needed for an ambitious package. So let's cut the theatrics and get down to the real business this week.
Activists in Baku are calling for a special tax on the world's billionaires to help fund climate adaptation and mitigation, an idea some of Africa's major powers, including South Africa, support. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A Nigerian international affairs expert says India has long had people-to-people and business relationships with some African countries. And he says the recent visit of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi to Nigeria led the two countries to sign a memoranda of understanding on cultural exchange programs, cooperation in customs matters, and collaboration between the Surveyors General of Nigeria and India. Professor Joshua Bolarniwa is the Director of Research at the Nigerian Institute of International Affairs in Lagos. Bolarniwa spoke to reporter Mike Mbonye about Modi's visit, which ended Sunday. He starts by noting the two countries have had ties dating back to Nigeria's independence in 1960.
In other words, Nigeria-India relations have gone a long way. And now, this recent visit of Prime Minister Modi is a testament to a very robust robust relations between Nigeria and India. By implication, it means this relations or this relationship between Nigeria and India has gone to what we call binational commission.
Russia, India, China, and some other countries belong to the BRICS group of economies. Looking at the Russia-China-India dynamics at play, is India trying to make sure it has access to Africa's mineral markets?
Beyond India, beyond Russia, beyond China, even beyond the traditional Western allies, like US, UK, France, and others that Africa has had before now. India, too, has been in Africa for a very, very long time. But India had been a subtle, simple partner, as they have been. And in all sincerity, India has long ago established what we call people-to-people relations or diplomacy with some African countries. Take, for example, in Nigeria, there are more than 50,000 Indians living in Nigeria, and there are hundreds of Indian investments in Nigeria. There are also have been a serious business presence of Indians in Nigeria. Take, for example, after the government, when I say government, I mean federal government, and some state government, particularly Lagos. So government, after the government, India is the second highest employer of labor in Nigeria. Their investments, their industries, their companies, their businesses, they are everywhere. And they have been very subtle. They have been very subtle in their approach, or let's use approaches and whatever they do. You go to South Africa, you will see Indians who have been living there for decades, years, and all of that. Go to Mauritius. Go to other places. So, beyond Russia and China and the traditional Western powers, India has been coming. But what has happened presently now is that India is trying now to increase its presence in Africa, its significance in Africa, and its stake in Africa.
That was Joshua Ball Rinwa, Director of Research at the Nigerian Institute of International Affairs. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye on the telephone from Lagos, Nigeria. President-elect Donald Trump will come into office in January 2025 with unified control of the U.S. Congress. Republicans will hold majorities in both the Senate and House as the result of a mandate from American voters. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Jepson has more from Capitol Hill.
The new leader of the incoming Republican majority, U.S. Senate. John Thune is the incoming Senate Majority Leader.
We have a mandate from the American people. A mandate not only to clean up the mess left by the Biden-Harris-Schumer agenda, but also to deliver on President Trump's priorities.
Thune takes the top leadership role in the Senate after Mitch McConnell served in that position for 18 years. And he is already facing his first test. President-elect Donald Trump has proposed bypassing the Senate's constitutional role of approving cabinet nominees. Senator John Thune.
The Senate has an advise and consent role under the Constitution, so we will do everything we can to process his noms quickly, get them installed in their position so they can begin to implement his agenda.
Democrats lost their majority and will hold at least 47 seats in the new Senate. Chuck Schumer is the current majority leader in the U.S. Senate.
The American people have presented us with a challenge. We must learn from it.
Trump had unified control of government during the first 2 years of his first term. But one analyst says that does not always mean the White House will get what it wants on Capitol Hill. Casey Burgett is Legislative Affairs Program Director at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C.
Mitch McConnell had said then that he supports the president's agenda. He'll work with them. But then we saw from nominations to policies that they will provide no votes if they think the president has gone too far.
Republicans also secured a majority in the U.S. House of Representatives, earning praise from Trump.
It's nice to win.
The president-elect endorsed Speaker of the House Mike Johnson to lead again.
I believe it will be the most consequential Congress in the modern era, most consequential administration in the modern era, because frankly, we have to fix almost every area of public policy.
But Republicans hold a much narrower majority in the House with only a handful more seats than Democrats who vowed to keep fighting. Democratic Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal.
The Congressional Progressive Caucus will continue to be ferocious defenders of the working class and poor people.
The new 119th U.S. Congress will be sworn into office on January 3rd.
Catherine Jepson, VOA News, Washington.
VOA.
VOA Africa has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Ihayes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Adrius Regas, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.